Amish the Buddha, Amish the Dharma, Amish the Sangha. Well, I've had a week of not doing any talks after a long, long months of doing talks. Today's talk is on, it can be regarded as a kind of footnote talk. I think the talks I'll be doing in the near future will all be footnote talks, I think, to the series on how to grow lotus blossom. And this is a talk on the spiritual cooking. And the Reverend Master doesn't use that metaphor in How to Grow Lotus Blossom, but he talked a lot about it later, in later years. And it's important because it brings the element of time in a way that lotus blossom doesn't. A tremendous amount happened in the period of less than a year for River Master there in How to Grow Lotus Blossom. Tremendous amount happened. And River Master told me later, and I, in my own experience, it's true, you know, that many of the things in How to Grow Lotus Blossom experiences would more normally be spread over a period of as much as 20 years, maybe longer. Why was it condensed into such an incredibly short time there? Well, you know, of course we can speculate, but I've always thought, you know, there are two main reasons. One of them is that, and River Master herself said this, well, I was right, really truly at the edge of death there. So a lot had to happen. But I think it's not just it had to happen for her, it had to happen for all of her disciples. We had to get the deeper orientation that experience and her teaching then that came out of that experience provided. We needed it badly. So a lot had to happen there. And the teaching that came out, it had to come out really fast. Boomity, 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 boom. Because the need was so great. Not only her need, but others' need. I think especially others' need. She had said when she first went to the monastery in Japan, at the gates of Soju, she said, what do you want here? And she said, the perfection of Zen. Why are you here? I want the perfection of Zen. I'm here for the perfection of Zen. You know, the Eternal has very good hearing. She got the perfection of Zen. You know, what is it to be truly be her disciple? Well, what is it to be a disciple? It's to follow in the footsteps of the Master. So if we're in the following in the footsteps of someone who asked for the perfection of Zen, then that's what we're asking for, whether we know it or not. I mean, I would have been terrified to say something that audacious. But now I know it to be true. And I know that that's what I'm in it for, too. Now it doesn't seem audacious. It just seems, well, I mean, it's courageous. She had incredible courage. And it's why settle for less when the perfection of Zen can be realized? Why settle for less? So we all needed it, and we've needed it ever since. It's the teaching for us, for those who long for the perfection of Zen. The deeper teaching, the deeper training that goes with that teaching were revealed at that time. And it needed a very full revelation. You say the whole period since has been exploring the implications of that teaching and that deeper training in the lives of not only River Master, but in the lives of all her disciples. And now her grand disciples as well. So there's both the immediate need of her master herself, and then there's the need of all her disciples, and the longer term need of all of us to in that teaching and be able to train it, you know, to have the possibility at least to train at that level, whether as individuals we would choose to do so or not. Well, that's it up to us. It's not up to her or up to the Eternal or up to anyone else. It's up to each of us. To the best of my ability, I choose to go that way. So the teaching on the spiritual cooking, it has to do with the fact that the process of training is spread out over time. And to say the process of training is spread out over time is the same as to say the process of conversion of greed, hate, and delusion into compassion, love, and wisdom has to be spread out over time. And, you know, it's spread out over a lifetime or over lifetimes. We can't really say when the process began of the conversion of karma. We can see points along the way. But if we think in terms of the, as I talked about in the series of talks on Lotus Blossom, we think in terms of the need and the help. Well, when you've got a really big need, say you've got a really big wad of, say, delusion, of ignorance, or a really big wad of clinging, or a really big wad of anger, really big wad of saddened love, of grief, you can see why it's not normally the case that that all gets converted all in one whack. And one like lightning flash. When you go through some of the physical aspects of the conversion process, you're glad that it doesn't happen all at once, because you could see where it could just kill you for a really big lump. It takes time for the conversion to happen. So one of the ways to describe part of this, an important part of this process, is in terms of a metaphor of cooking. And so I want to talk a little bit about, first about the heat source in the cooking. The heat source has a couple aspects. One aspect is, you might say, is the aspect from the help side. And the other aspect is the aspect from the need side. This is such a useful thing, but it's always, remember, all those columns, except the fifth column, have two poles, as it were. The eternal end and the need end. Or it can be thought of in that way. It's not the only way it can be thought of, but it can be helpful. So the help side and the need side. The help side of the cooking. River Master used to say, and this, I always, when she first said this, it really is one of those things that just strikes you. No one else would come up with something like this. You know, this has got to be coming from the deepest possible experience. She said, before we ever long for the eternal longed for us. Before any of us ever longed for the eternal longed for us. That however much we think that we're stumbling along in the dark without help, in actual fact, there was always this call coming to us, this call of love. What does it mean to say the eternal longs for us? Well, for crying out loud, it's a love that's calling out to us. A love that's longing to be reunited with that which it loves. And that loves enough not to try to force it. It's a love with a tremendous respect in it. And it's always calling. So that's the help side of the heat source for the cooking. is the fact that there's this pull from the eternal, this call from the eternal. And whenever we just tune in spiritually, we, in a sense, hear it or sense the call. And that stimulates something in us. And what does it stimulate? It stimulates the need side of the heat source, which is our longing and our will. Our longing and our will. So, the longing of the eternal for what River Master so magnificently called full recognized reunion with itself, of all that karmic need. The longing for the eternal stimulates the latent longing in us. And this is, the people experience this. I never experienced it as a lay person, so I don't know how people as lay trainees experience it. Well, I've said before that in the period leading up to my first Kensho, the period of the 2 months where I was cooking mightily and very intensely, the longing was at times beyond belief. You know, it was just something in me was reaching out so powerfully. And in the period right after my Kensho, it was the experience of being in love as fully or more fully than you could ever be in love with anyone or anything. In love with the eternal. It's interesting, St. John of the Cross talks about that longing. And talks about it being in, and other Christian mystics as well, at times an incredible anguish. Oh, living, the living flame of love. You know, a flame that sometimes burns. It's often sometimes also spoken of as a sword that pierces. But you never hear him say, oh, I wish it wasn't there. You see? It's just that, and this is what actually happens, is that when the heart is finally focused and the will is finally focused on the eternal, then all the scattered longings and cravings coalesce into this one longing, which is what they always were in their essence. The longing for the eternal. And that is like the, I want to use another little metaphor here, but you know, if you go out to the ocean and you look at the out into the ocean there where the waves are just starting to show themselves. Just starting to show themselves. That's where that longing is. It starts in the kind of small little undulations and then it gradually grows until this great wave. This great wave. It's there in the little moments of longing love. It's there in those little flashes. One day, when all conditions ripen, all that grows into a great wave, and one is swept into the arms of the eternal on that wave in a Kensho. Now, I know lay trainees who've had Kensho, so I know they've experienced this. So there you have the two aspects of the heat source. It's the fire of spiritual longing, focus on the eternal. It's the fire of the will that responds to that longing and says, "Right, I'm going for it." You know, well, when I long for chocolate, you know, I don't get chocolate unless I put my will into it. But once my will is behind it, you can't stop me getting my chocolate. And that's the way it is with the longing for the eternal. Once a person's really given their will and their willingness to it, you can't stop them getting to the eternal. That's why people who blame the master, you know, you guys need to think twice. The master's not stopping you getting enlightened, even if the master's a total idiot. The master's not stopping you getting enlightened. You know, wake up. The only person who can stop me is me. We all really know that deep inside ourselves. The only one who can stop you is you. So that's the he source. So what is it that is the vessel of the in which something is being cooked? We're going to murder this poor metaphor, you know, before I'm done here. But I'm in solid ground here. This is one of the old metaphors that's used going back many centuries. The vessel is this body and mind. And what is contained in the vessel is the mixture of karmic confusion, pain, and merit. The mixture of karmic confusion, pain, and merit. And this stuff's got to be brought into the essential heart of the vessel, right where the fire, right above where the fire is, and that's the hara. It's got to be brought into the hara in meditation. All that need, mixing with the merit, you know, mixing in there and mixing with that, the help that's being sent from the eternal. It's got to mix in there. And you know, one of the you know, great metaphors is called in the teaching on reharmonization, the gathering the herbs and putting them into the pot to make a what? To make a soup, to cook soup. It says, by listening to what cannot be heard, we make our existence warmer. We heat up. To listening to that what cannot be heard. Listen to the eternal. Stop listening to that which can be heard and turn inwards and listen to that which can't be heard. And yet, we can hear it. You know, listen to the still small voice. Forget listening and not listening, just be still and turn inwards. By listening to what cannot be heard, we make our existence warmer. That starts to, when you put the energy into the meditation, that turns on the fire. That gets things warming up. By looking at what cannot be seen, we will bring peace to our fears. By looking at what cannot be seen, we will bring peace to our fears. This is referring to one of the teachings on the eyes in meditation, basically. It's saying, turn the eyes inwards. Well, of course, I think Ramathur said that sometimes people actually try to, like, roll their eyes back in their heads or something. You know, to do this. But it doesn't mean that, of course. It means allow the eyes to be part open and part closed and turn within spiritually. There's always someone who takes it in some daft literal way. By the way, guilty as charged. I haven't done that particular one, but I've done daft literal things before. I suppose most of us have. By looking at what cannot be seen, we will bring peace to our fears. And this is talking about the fact that when we're spiritually ripe, we're inwardly agitated and anxious, and the fear and longing are all kind of stewing around. And we have to draw within. We have to draw within. Master used to say, the reason why the temple has fences and gates is to keep the world out, not to keep people in. The reason why we control the senses is not to limit our own true spiritual freedom, but it's to keep worldliness out so that the eternal can get a word in edgeways, and that's meditation. You say no to worldliness and to the being scattered out, spread out in the world. You draw within to your true center. And then that agitation and those fears and that anxiety that starts to calm down. I mean, how many times has everyone in this room experienced that? Where you sit down in an agitated frame of mind, 30 minutes later you get up and you feel much more peaceful. You might even not remember for a moment, what was it that was bothering me when I sat down? But we've all experienced it. Then it says, that which makes us wander about in what is uncompassionate and hard to bear will naturally change. And that is talking about transformation. That is saying, now the herbs are in the pot and the cooking's happening and the transformation is happening. The cooking is a metaphor. What is cooking? When we cook food, it transforms the food. Sometimes into something that's actually inedible as it is, into something that's edible. Sometimes it's just a matter of we enjoy the taste better or it's easier to digest or something. But in some cases, some foods, you actually can't eat them until they're cooked like the dickens. I think of yucca root. You know, some of you maybe had yucca root. You know, I had it down in the tropics. I had it. You know, it's eaten a lot down in South America. It's just starch, basically. Fibrous starch. I think it's... is it also called manioc? Is that the same as manioc? I think it is. Anyway, you got to cook the dickens out of this stuff before you can eat it. You know, even then, I don't think it has any actual nutrition. But it's just starch. But think of the karmic need as needing a lot of meditational cooking. A lot of bringing together. What are the herbs you put in the pot? What's that merit from the past? And it's the help from the eternal. They've got to meet together. They've got to be brought together. And meditation brings them together. That longing of the eternal for us is always there. That love of the eternal for us is always there. We just need to take a step towards it. Remember that when I talked about the second column, I quoted a similar quote that says, the Buddha nature offers to the untrue and the uncompassionate that which is hard to bear, its cleansing energy. This is why when you're training in that second column, it can be so painful, and at the same time, you can have such a certainty that of the love of the eternal, and a certainty of the goodness of the painful process you're going through. Because that which is uncompassionate and hard to bear, that which is untrue and uncompassionate comes up for the eternal's help, the karma comes due then. And feeling is a reaper of karma, so there's this painful feeling. But the painful feeling that's being experienced, and at the deepest level, it's just pure states of feeling, pure fear, terror, pure hatred, pure grief, above all grief. You know, fear and grief, those are the really intense ones. And that means the karma's there, you know, crying out for the help. The need is there, crying out for the help. And the help that has to be given is the help of pure meditation, the help of the activity of pure faith. What people do is that they seek an external help. Seek help outwards in other people's, in the consolation offered by others. And all mystical paths involve or have with them the teaching that the consolation that ultimately has to be sought is the consolation of the eternal. Because the consolation of man will not satisfy that deepest need. No true mystic, however, no experienced mystic is saying that human love has no place. Human love can at times have a very, very important place in this process. And if we're trying to make it substitute for the love of the eternal, it won't work. The place that human love has in this process is the place given by the eternal and then taken by the eternal when the timing is right. Otherwise, we just do the same old thing we've always done. We'll make a mess of it. There simply is no substitute for taking the burden to the eternal and leaving it in the hands of the eternal and then sitting through both the joys and the pains of this process. Again, all the teachings on this process emphasize you have to be patient. You have to be willing to put whatever time is required in on it. You have to go about it in a sensible, grounded way. This is why we have the kind of schedules we have in the monastery. The schedule is the best shot we can give at helping keep this cooking process tootling along at just the right clip. As people go on, it turns out that different people need a somewhat different, everyone needs a slightly different schedule, actually. Everyone needs, you know, the general schedule of a monastery is an approximation. Especially as people get more experienced, they need to have their own individual little variations on the theme. The same basic theme is needed for everyone. Some kind of regular turning within in pure meditation. And enough time in the day given to that for that day's amount of cooking to happen. Otherwise, you just end up spiritually starving. And this, of course, is why contemplative monks cannot be social workers. Because you can't do two things equally well. You can't devote the amount of time you need to pure meditation and also be so involved in the world. You know, in other words, as I've always said, or said for many years anyway, in order to do this really well, you have to specialize. If you're going to be a true contemplative, you have to specialize. Be willing not to do a lot of things that other people do. At least not in the way other people do them. And your sole commitment, your full commitment has to be to the inner life and to the training that is involved in keeping that fire under the pot going. And if you try it another way, you'll end up not being a good, thorough contemplative and also not being a good social worker either, as a matter of fact. We're messy, so put it real simply. You can't ride one horse, or you can't ride two horses with one behind. You can't ride two horses with one behind. For the same reason, you can't just mix religious practices and teachings and have it work. You have to be focused. You have to be very focused. You have to be dedicated to one path. If you put in the time on that, it works. It doesn't work because of someone else. It works because of you and because of the eternal. I've told this story many times. I'll tell it once again. You know, not long before she died, when I was alone with her master in her den at the Abbey, I just said to her, I just want to thank you for all you've done for me. And her master just looked at me and she said, "You did it all yourself, friend." And I can't hardly tell that story without breaking into tears. And at the time, I felt like breaking into tears because I know what she did for me. And I know why she said what she said. She wasn't a magician. I had to do the work. She could help me, yes, at key times, help me in a way that I feel saved my life spiritually. But she couldn't do it for me. When we live our life away from the special time during the day of wholly devoted to meditation and contemplation, when we do the things that are good to do through the day, doing our what we call our working meditation, our relaxing meditation, our eating meditation, and so on. That's when we're gathering the herbs. We're gathering the herbs. That's meritorious activity. We're doing the best we can to live by the precepts, to do that which is good for self and other. There is, of course, a place for selfless activity, and actually to think of meditation as selfish activity is a gross distortion and a falsehood. Those who truly live a contemplative life live an unselfish life, beyond self and other, really, above the opposites. That's the gathering the herbs. Then you bring the herbs back to the pot. You know, go get. Think of the herbs as all the stuff you're going to put in that pot to make a good soup. Then you got your heat going under it. You bring it into the hara in meditation. It's in the pot. Cookie, cookie, cookie. And then guard the soup from the idle and curious. That's a Dogen's instructions as the chief cook. But you guard your soup from the idle and curious. Guard what's in the pot. Treasure it and guard it and let it cook away. You know, for me, my day begins after supper when I go down from my corpse pose meditation I do every evening after supper. That's when my day begins. Our master used to say that the meditational day begins in the evening. And for me, that is really the truth. That's when my day begins. Then I have the whole night for a quiet cooking to happen. Sometimes I'm asleep, sometimes I'm not. Often I'm awake in the night for sometimes for hours, sometimes just for a short time. Sometimes sitting in meditation, sometimes just lying there kind of contemplating. Sometimes just feeling fried and tired. But it's all part of the cooking. That's a kind of quiet cooking. Then in the morning you meditate, you go out into the day's activities. You want to just hold fast to the Lord of the house through those activities. And do the best you can not to forget, you know, what it is your real focus in doing them. And that way, during the day, you're gathering more stuff to bring into the pot. But it's not the external things, of course. It's the merits being made that will help when you bring it into the pot. It gets combined with all that need in there, the raw stuff, and cooks away. It makes good soup. You know, day in and day out, patience, faith. Patience, faith. And steadfast effort. Buddha, Amish of the Dharma, Amish of the Sangha.